Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow, to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.
Hi, we're Visible, the wireless company with nothing to hide. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Sorry, hidden fees, we're just not into you. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com. It's on!
Hi, everyone, from New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network. This is Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I'm Larry David with 100% less worthless FTX shares. Pretty, pretty good. Just kidding. This is On with Kara Swisher, and I'm Kara Swisher.
And I'm Naima Raza. You also have 100% fewer lawsuits, I think.
Yes, I think so. Those are coming.
I do love Curb Your Enthusiasm,
Me too, I have to say. I love it, but, you know, it's not a good look for him.
Everybody was in bed with Sam Bankman-Fried.
Let's not sexualize Sam Bankman-Fried. It's just not where I want to go on this today.
I wasn't.
I know. I just realized.
I mean, the person who may have been in bed with him was the Alameda CEO, who he reportedly had this on and off again relationship with.
Honestly, it's the least sexy sex scandal I've ever heard. Anyway.
Okay. Our guest today is legendary writer and comedian Eric Idle.
Yes.
Kara, tell the people who Eric Idle is.
You know, Eric Idle is one of these people who changed my life. Monty Python, greatest sketch comedy troupe of all time, and from which everybody else emerged. And they put together something that really, truly lasts the test of time. I ended up watching a lot of it before this interview, and it brought me back, and it also didn't feel irrelevant at all.
Before you talk to Eric, we wanted to discuss this broader idea of lines in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's getting a lot of attention right now in the wake of Dave Chappelle's recent SNL monologue, which has caused some consternation and backlash.
I'm sort of in the middle between that. I know that Jonathan Greenblatt, who I've interviewed many times from the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, took issue with some of his comments, but I thought he was... I think he towed the line, I guess. I've had some issues with Chappelle and have written about it. I think his weird obsession with trans people is both exhausting and also not funny after a while. I don't mind a joke or two. I don't mind his lesbian jokes and this and that. But at some point you're like, can you move along from this group? And it's not funny anymore. And then it's really more about you than the jokes. But I thought in this case, he was very funny during that monologue.
So this SNL monologue kicked off with a disclaimer. He theatrically pulls out a piece of paper and then he reads a statement. Let's hear it.
I denounce anti-Semitism in all its forms. And I stand with my friends in the Jewish community. And that, Kanye, is how you buy yourself some time.
He then went on to discuss heated topics from Kanye's anti-Semitic remarks, which led to a company founded by Nazis dropping him. Mm-hmm. And he also spoke about suspended Brooklyn Nets star Kyrie Irving, which is one of the few basketball players you and I have heard of.
Because he's a jerk, but go ahead.
Yeah, because he tweeted a controversial documentary, and I'm putting air quotes around documentary, and had all kinds of anti-Semitic information. There was also a middle bit about Trump being an honest liar that no one seems to think was controversial, but he started and ended on the other stuff, and he's been called out by a number of people.
Yeah.
So did you watch it?
I did. Most of it I thought was very funny. That's the problem with Chappelle is, you know, he's obviously, you know, I hate to sound like someone who's like, Kanye's music is great. This guy's an amazing comic. And he just can't, he indulges himself in wasteful controversy, I think. And I don't mind comics being controversial.
That's kind of the point. That's part of the point.
It is the point. Yeah. But most of the stuff that's really good is just really good. He's doing something else is happening at the same time he's making great comedy. And you can see it when he's about to do it.
Well, you can see how he's looking for the reaction, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, to me, is a bad sign for anyone.
Well, he's provocative. He's provoking.
Yeah, but, you know, everyone who writes or does anything, and you make videos, and I write and stuff like that, knows when a line is just too good. Like, you're like, I'm going to put this one in. Like, I often take them out because I'm like, it's too clever by a half, and it's indulgent in a way that's not doesn't serve the art, I guess. I think he was playing with the idea that he might be an anti-Semite, but I don't think he is. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing where he said this joke where if you're black, then it's a gang. If they're Italian, it's a mob. But if they're Jewish, it's a coincidence and you should never speak about it.
Yeah, and he's doing a trope there about the supposed power of Jewish people in Hollywood.
Yeah, I'm Italian, my family, but...
Are you part of a mob?
We are.
If you're a straight girl, it's a girl band. Spice Girls.
And if it's a lesbian, it's the Melissa Etheridge. I get why people are upset by that. I sure do. Mm-hmm. Though I don't think it's even close to the level of a Kanye West or a Kyrie Irving or anything else. I think he's playing with people in a way that's probably not very nice. But
he's towing the line. He's like, remember that Catherine Zeta-Jones film where mm-hmm. she's like going under the lasers in a black suit?
Yeah. He's doing exactly that.
He doesn't look as good as she did when she did it. But, you know, he's trying to dance around. And I don't agree with the points he made. I don't know if he agrees with the points he made.
Yeah.
But I think the performance is the exhibition. And the comedy is, I think, Jerry Seinfeld said, was well executed, even if the subject matter merited a broader conversation. Mm-hmm. But he is a master of the craft.
He really is. He really
is. Storytelling. He really did a wraparound on Kanye. The Trump part in the middle gets the audience back with him when he's just gone too far. I think he's trying to air a theory that, you know, some groups have more power over what we can and can't say than others.
I don't agree with that. I think, I'm going to go back to the trans because I think he went way over the line with trans people in a way that wasn't funny. It wasn't even slightly funny. And then he talks about himself and how beleaguered and a victim. I mean, then he sounds like Trump. I'm the victim here. Mm. And then you're like, shut the fuck up and get off stage. In this case, I think he did a pretty good job.
Look, I mean, I'm Muslim. I'm American, but I didn't grow up here. And when I moved back to the country, it was around September 11th. And at the time, I think we had a family friend who was an actor, and his only gig was like playing a terrorist in films. And if you went to, you know, I go to stand-up clubs, and people were making a lot of jokes about, you know, would you hold the bag of a Muslim guy in an airport who told you you had to go pray, or whatever the joke was. And I found it offensive. Mm-hmm. But I'm also a storyteller. I mean, producer, make films, make videos, write stuff. And I think that even though it offends me, it should be allowed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I think it's cheap.
He did say something about how it's hard to talk about stuff.
It shouldn't be this scary to talk about anything. It's making my job incredibly difficult. And to be honest with you, I'm getting sick of talking to a crowd like this. I love you to death. And I thank you for your support. And I hope they don't take anything away from me. Whoever they are.
That was somewhat funny.
What do you think about the argument he's making? It shouldn't be this scary to talk about anything.
It's not that scary to talk about
anything. I think it is hard to talk about. Even in this conversation, you're not saying, like, it's funny. It's not. Like, you don't think it's a little bit of a delicate dance in this day and age to talk about things that are sensitive?
I think Dave Chappelle is an enormous platform. So him, no.
Yeah. New up-and-coming comedians, sure.
I don't know. I think it's overblown. I hear it from a lot of people. I've heard it from major Hollywood moguls who own everything and play the victim. I think there's a lot of people who never got a voice. Hmm. And to kick them in the teeth continually, that you shouldn't do that is not censorship, is just don't be an asshole. And many times Chappelle is being an asshole.
The thing you're saying about certain groups who've never had a voice, do you think certain groups should be protected in comedy? For example, a trans community, or, you know, I gave the example of Muslims, or you don't think?
No, not protected, but not smacked over the head with a 2x4 a long time.
You think that he has a lot of career left in him?
Oh, yeah. He'll be just fine.
Yeah.
He'll be just fine.
Well, I mean, here to talk to us about comedy and where the line is these days is Eric Idle. So let's talk about our guest today.
He's amazing. Now, speaking of which, someone who says a lot of stuff and they make fun of a lot of people, but somehow it's not cruel.
The Brits are just better, Kara. I'm an Anglophile. The Brits are just better.
These particular Brits are better, I think.
He was pitched to me originally by a friend, and you wrote back, in all caps,
yeah,
I love him.
I do.
Which is such a rarity for you to say, Kara.
Oh, that's not true. It's
not true. Mostly you reserve it for, like, Dolly Parton.
Yes.
Taylor Swift.
Deserved.
People in the Nashville,
yes,
Tennessee area.
I love a country music singer. Now, of course, Faith Hill and Tim McGraw from 1883, things like that.
But what about Eric Idle?
I love Eric Idle. I like the whole Monty Python group, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, Graham Chapman, Terry Gilliam, John Cleese, obviously. And I've loved them for years. When I was a kid, I watched it at night on my little TV, my little tiny little TV in my room. And I loved everything.
You had your own TV in your own room when you were a kid?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, Kara. Fancy.
Anyway, I would watch Spam, 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 and Spanish Inquisition, and The Cheese Shop was one of my favorite. And of course, I saw Life of Brian. And
that's the one about Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So
it was very risque.
It was. It was great. It was always be on the bright side of life with him singing that. I just loved every. They gave me so much pleasure as a group. And Eric Idle was one of, you know, they were all great. They were all great. And so he gave me so much pleasure as a comedian. I owe a debt of gratitude as a young woman to him. Younger.
I think he's going to give you a lot of pleasure in this interview as well, Kara, because he's been also quite obsessed with the topic of death. He's recently survived pancreatic cancer. And I know death is one of the most joyful topics for you to speak about. You love it.
It is. I love talking about it. I'm excited to discuss it with him. And I'm glad he is doing well and is in good shape right now.
What are you excited to get out of this interview besides, you know, trading death notes with Eric Idle?
Well, I want to know what he's doing. I want to know about comedy, sort of the state of comedy. These guys were way before Saturday Night Live and everything else. And what does he think about that now? He's quite active on Twitter, very liberal. I'd love to know about British politics. Mm-hmm. I want to know what he thinks is funny. What are you interested in?
I know they used to get edited by BBC a bit for pushing the line. So I'm curious to know where he thinks that line is.
Yeah.
And his different experiences working with BBC versus NBC.
All right. Okay. Get it
so
in there.
Maybe I'll ask.
Maybe I won't. We'll see.
Oh, come
we'll
on,
say I
Kara.
Want to talk. No.
Be
I want
nice.
To talk about spam.
Soon you'll be dead.
Spam.
Until then,
I'll
be
have
nice.
Spam. Eggs and spam. That's what I'll have. I want to talk about spam.
All right. Enjoy.
Support for this episode comes from SAS. SAS is going all in on AI to help the world get more done with data. See for yourself in Las Vegas, April 16th to 19th at SAS Innovate, the data and AI experience for everyone and every role, from top executives to data scientists, engineers, analysts, and more. I'll be there leading a panel discussion about the importance of responsible AI. It's just one of the many sessions that will highlight the massive potential of AI. Visit innovate.sas.com and use the code Kara to save $100 on registration. I'll see you there.
Can cities fine or jail people who are unhoused for sleeping outside?
The crisis is in people's face more, so they're more upset about it. There's more pressure on politicians to do something. But the thing that they could really do to address the problem will take time, and they're sort of hearing from people who don't want to wait for something that takes time.
This week on The Weeds, the Supreme Court case that could change homelessness in this country, for better or for worse.
It is on.
I've spent the last couple of days revisiting my childhood and youth and listening to all your work and watching it. And I've been a big Monty Python fan for years, and I'd watch it late at night by myself, and it was always just wonderful and so funny. It was conceived 50 years ago or more in the late 60s, and it's still a hit. Spamalot's on Broadway. Some of your films on Netflix are some of the most popular. The reunion tours sell out. I have to say, watching it, it stands the test of time in a way that I was surprised. Talk to me a little about why you think that's the case.
Well, I'm not sure I really know, but I think it shouldn't be. I mean, for comedy to last more than 50 years is actually very, very rare. And we weren't certainly looking back 50 years when we were doing it. So I try and wonder, because one thing we were certain of is it would never go to America, that they would never ever get it. So we were completely wrong there. But then when I think about it more, I think it's because it's very silly, and it keeps playing with the form. I think it's about television in an odd way, because we were the first people to do that sort of comedy on television in color in our country anyway.
Right, and skits, really.
And it's not satire, but it is satire. It's generic satire. It's about types. Mm-hmm. It isn't about particular people. So the references haven't dated. So, for example, it's not like SNL where you say, oh, I remember, he was the president who always fell over. It is either funny or it isn't. And also the other thing I think is quite strange and unique. It was written by the people who did it. and mm-hmm. only by them.
Right.
There was no writing team.
Right.
You know, it was just by us, just what we wanted to say. And I think we'd done our Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours. We'd done other mm-hmm. shows. We'd been writers mm-hmm. for other people. We'd been on television. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the BBC gave us this complete freedom to do what the heck we wanted. And we didn't have a clue what to do. we just did it. We made it up and did it.
You talk about that, the types, you know, the wink, wink, nudge, nudge guy, which you're famous for. You're famous for a lot of different characters, Sir Robin. So you wrote each of these things, or you wrote for each other, correct?
We wrote them. We didn't cast till after we'd written the shows. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that people weren't hanging on to bits because they were in it or they'd written it. And then we tried to give it a sort of theme, or we tried to link things together without using tags or punchlines. And I think that's where Gilliam was important.
This is Terry Gilliam.
Because he provides the show with a sort of Victorian framework mm-hmm. in which the whole thing plays out. And that seems to give it some link and connection, which mm-hmm. is entirely spurious.
So those were those animations. Those were those
the animations,
the
yes.
foot, the foot, or people being squashed or eaten by a baby. Or
and that would be entirely his own whimsy. And he'd come up with it at the very last minute, and we wouldn't see it often until we went recording it before a live audience. And that was the other cue. It was a live audience, so they mm-hmm. told us what was funny and what wasn't. And we weren't always right.
As opposed to a laugh track, right?
Well, as opposed entirely to a laugh track. And sometimes that was surprising to us. Only once did we make a big mistake, and we thought, mm-hmm. and we did it again the next week, and it was still didn't get a laugh. So we thought, no, it definitely.
What was it?
It was a very silly sketch. It was set in the trenches, and I think I was playing a harmonica, and maybe I was talking. Somebody said, hey, Sergeant, I can't wait to get back, you know, to old Blighty, you know, see the wife. Mm-hmm. Some pie and chips. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, Sergeant said, yes, Brigadier. And that's all it was. It was like a class joke. And it takes a while for it to penetrate. But the audience reacted like you did, stunned silence.
Right.
I mean, to be funny, we find ourselves laughing. We don't think about it. We find ourselves to be laughing.
Right, absolutely. If you have to explain the joke, that's the whole thing. You were Oxbridgers, except Terry Gilliam, including you, Terry Jones, Graham Chapman, John Cleese, and Michael Palin. Talk about how you came together as a group, because you were just given this show, and it became a hit, and especially in the United States.
Well, we were all at Oxford or Cambridge, and in Cambridge, there's a thing called the Footlights Club, which I happened to mm-hmm. join. And by extraordinary coincidence, I met John Cleese in January of 1963. And then the same year, I met Graham Chapman. And then at Edinburgh Festival, I met Terry Jones and then Michael Palin. So by the end of like 12 months, we'd actually met each other. But when we came down from Cambridge, my first job was writing for David Frost mm-hmm. on a show called The Frost Report, which mm-hmm. which John Cleese starred in. So mm-hmm. There was that. We were writers. We were young. And then we got our own children's show, Do Not Adjust Your Set, Michael Palin, mm-hmm. Terry Jones and I. And so we had our own TV show, which was a very big hit at 5:25 for kids. So we couldn't use any filth. It was great, good discipline. You know, you just had to be purely funny. And we decided we wouldn't talk down to them. We would just do our funny stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there was another show called The 1948 Show. And these two shows collided, mm-hmm. oddly. And the BBC said, you know, you can have 13 shows on a Sunday night. Mm-hmm. They were trying to find out if there was an audience on Sunday night after you saw the Queen on a horse and they'd say goodnight and shut down. So mm-hmm, mm-hmm. they didn't really mind what we did. They didn't care. They didn't watch.
Right.
They didn't even read the scripts. They just said, well, get on and do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We started off in 66 writing for television mm-hmm. and being on it in 67. And mm-hmm. Python started in 69. And then mm-hmm. it didn't take off in a big way. I mean, nobody really started to watch. And then people occasionally went, they began to really love it. Mm-hmm. And I think because we messed with the form of it, sometimes right. we'd start with 10 minutes of a pirate film to try mm-hmm. and persuade them they were on the wrong channel. So
right.
I think messing with them was a very good thing to do.
Now, you said you're not an actor. You talked about different people in the cast and that you don't do character acting, but you call it caricature acting. Can you explain two things you said that I thought were interesting? That, and then you said uncomfortable is very good for comedy.
We're writer performers. So I think we're much more close akin to caricature. It isn't a deeply thought out character that you could live with on for a long time. And I have no idea what the other thing was referring to. Was there a context?
You were filming. I don't think it was Life of Brian. I think it was Holy Grail. And it was, you had a hard time with your castles. You couldn't get into castles. And you said it made it better that you had less to work with.
And less money. I think that's true. I think the fact is the Holy Grail was made for $400,000 was the budget.
Right.
5 weeks filming.
And
because of that, exactly. Because of that, we couldn't afford horses anyway, although they'd already written the horse sketch at the beginning, everybody had to have coconuts because we couldn't afford horses. So I think it forces you to improvise or create something which you might just lazily have not done.
Yeah, although I wonder where you got coconuts in Scotland at that time of year, but nonetheless.
Well, there was a whole sketch about that, you know.
Yeah.
So you parodied. It's tropical.
It's tropical, exactly. You parodied everything. I want to do a little lightning round of how you look at them now in these sketches. Let me start with the wink, wink, nudge, nudge, guys.
You married?
Yes.
I'm a bachelor myself. Is your wife a goer? Hey, know what I mean? Know what I mean? Nudge, nudge, know what I mean? Say no more.
Beg your pardon?
Your wife, does she go? Hey, know what I mean? Know what I mean? Does she go? Hey?
She sometimes goes.
Oh, I bet she does. I bet she does. Say no more.
Is that your most famous character or not? How do you look at him?
I would say so because, oddly enough, Elvis Presley was a big fan of that sketch and called everybody Squire because of it. Uh-huh. But the oddest thing of all is I wrote it for a show. We used to say, well, we would read our sketches out to each other. Mm-hmm. And if we laughed, we'd put it in the show. And if we didn't laugh, we'd sell it to the two Ronnies. It was a television show, Ronnie Barker and Ronnie Corbett, and very, very popular.
So you'd give them your cast-offs.
Yes, it wasn't good enough for us, but it was still pretty funny, you know. But we didn't try that one. I'd already sent that into the two Ronnies, and they sent it back, because if you look at it on the page, it's not funny. There's no jokes in it.
Right.
Is your wife a go? No, what to me? No, what to me? No, she says, no, what to me? Say no more, say no more, say no more. Hello, is she? You know, it's just repetition. Until you do it like that, you know, she go. Once you put the caricature in it, it becomes funny. So once I read it to the rest of the Pythons, they just laughed and said, that's in, you know, just straight away.
Oh, it's fantastic. It works very well today. Ruddles, though, I thought was great. One of the first mockumentaries, if not the first.
No, it's 6 years before Spinal Tap. And I wrote it for, initially, it was just a little song and a little sequence on a television show I had after Python called Rutland Weekend Television. Rutland being the tiniest county in England and having been just put out of existence by the Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. So the idea being that, you know, they had no money, no budget, and everything was it's the small and the large, which is very good for comedy. It always works, really. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was a little group called the Ruttles running around singing very Beatley songs.
Ouch, you're breaking my heart. Ouch, I'm falling apart. Ouch, 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 ouch. When we first met, I must admit, I felt for you right from the start.
And so when I went first on Saturday Night Live, I was hosting it, Lorne asked me for a clip from my show, and I showed him this, and he played it on the show. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they had letters back from the audience to the Ruttles. And then he said, well, what are you going to do next? And I said, well, I'm going to do a documentary on the Ruttles for BBC Two. And he said, well, why don't you do it for me and NBC and you'll have a larger budget? Mm-hmm. And so that's how it came to be. It's like a combination between Rutland Weekend Television and Saturday Night Live, because all the Saturday Night Live people were on, Gilda. And
the idea was, I love Gilda Radner, another amazing.
She was a wonderful friend. I mean, we knew her quite well.
So let me go through them. Life of Brian, which I think you jokingly, when it was originally, you called it Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory, which is my favorite thing ever. Why that?
Well, the question was asked me at the opening of Holy Grail, what's our next film? And I just ad-libbed, mm-hmm. Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory. You know, to get rid of the question. And when we got back to England, this is interesting. And we talked about it and we thought, well, actually nobody's ever done It's the same as right. the, nobody's ever done comedy about the Beatles either. So you like the blank page if you're doing comedy. It's fabulous to find a whole blank page. Then we decided, well, actually, you can't really mock Jesus because mm-hmm. he's saying all very good things. You can only mock mm-hmm. the followers who misinterpret it.
And so as a blasphemer, you are to be stoned to death. Look. I'd had a lovely supper, and all I said to my wife was, that piece of halibut was good enough for Jehovah.
And then we came up with the idea of really, it's a tragedy, because it's a guy mistaken for a Messiah. And there was a lot of fuss about it, because people didn't really see it. So they didn't mm-hmm. really understand it. They just complained, right. and it was this broad mass of, which made the film in America.
Right.
Everybody went to see it.
And one character you had in it was Stan Laretta. This is an early transgender character. That exchange between you, I think it was John Cleese, about not having a uterus or
yes.
a box or whatever.
Yes, yes.
How are you going to have a baby in a box? that was the first transgender character I think I ever saw in a popular movie.
It was written by John Cleese and Graham Chapman. And mm-hmm. I played it, which is a lovely mm-hmm. character to play. Mm-hmm. And it treats, you know, Stan Laretta very nicely in a way. I mean, they know, they go, well, how are you going to have, oh, so why do you want to be a woman? I want to have a baby. Well, how are you going to have a baby? I mean, yeah, where's the yeah. fetus going to, you're going to keep it in the box, you know?
Right.
So
right.
I think if we'd been unpleasant or attacked that character, it would have looked nasty mm-hmm. today. But mm-hmm. because it was sympathetic,
right?
And also, well, we voted to give him the right to have a baby.
Right.
So, you know, I thought that was very left wing, and I would have thought that was largely Graham Chapman, who was, you know, mm-hmm. was a gay man and out mm-hmm. at the mm-hmm. time, even though when we started, it was still illegal, which is very mm-hmm. hard to understand yeah. and remember in that it, you know, from that those times.
Oh, I do.
But it was a wonderful man and a great guy and
yeah.
and would come up with these, you know, offbeat thoughts, which I think balanced the very male group.
There was a lot of gay in there. I'm gay, yeah. and I saw a lot of gay in there, yeah. which is interesting. And then, of course, Mr. Cheeky, which you stuck with you for years. Always look on the bright side of life as you're sitting on the cross. Talk about that character.
Well, he was actually based on our electricians. So we thought like that. And you know, anything you want doing, if you want somebody, and Mr. Cheeky was ridiculously silly. I mean, he's supposed to be crucified, and he says, mm-hmm. No, they told me I could go free and live on an island. And he says, mm-hmm. well, off you go then, off you go. And he says, no, I'm only pulling your leg, really. it's invincible stupidity.
And yeah.
Originally, the song was not sung by him. I recorded mm-hmm. the song, and then when I got to Tunisia where we were filming, it suddenly occurred to me that it needed the character of Cheeky to sing it and sell it. You know, some things right, in my bed. And once I did that, which I recorded in a hotel room in Tunisia on a mattress
oh, wow.
with a bottle of Bucha, that's a live track. You know,
oh,
with
wow.
the with, yeah, so, it, but it brought the whole song to life and sold it at the end. And
yeah, it's very poignant, too. This is inspired by a Reddit user called The Bold Move. He was curious what the show's social commentary would still be relevant today. I think it is. So he asked you to pick one you'd rewrite, one that's absolute and one that's perfect exactly as it is. Can you think of those?
Well, I wrote and directed O2, which is a revival in 2014. And mm-hmm. the only thing I felt I should cut was that there was a thing in the Silly Olympics. Mm-hmm. And it was 100 yards, 100 meters for the deaf. Mm-hmm. And he said, on your marks, get set, go, bang. Nobody moves. Bang.
Yeah.
Nobody moves.
Right.
Bang. And I thought, no, this is actually laughing at the infirmity and not with the infirm. So I cut
mm-hmm.
that. I don't know what I can't think of what I would off the cuff, what I would rewrite now because mm-hmm. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it.
Right.
You know?
Right. But when you look back at a lot of comedy, you're like, I was watching something older and I was like, oh, no. I haven't found one in Monty Python that I found offensive, even by today's standards, which was interesting.
And I think because of the balance of the various members, I think Graham was a very prevalent influence in that. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. And even if you played gay characters, they were kind of, you know, they weren't mocking being gay. Mm-hmm. They were saying funny things in a gay character. Mm-hmm. And I think that possibly the clue is that if you were offending some part of your audience or upsetting them. That's not what comedy does. It tries to mock things that, you know, should be attacked.
Speaking of which, the show was magic because it reflected the culture, which was TV back then. What do you think the closest thing is now? Is it Saturday Night Live, which Monty Python predated, or something like Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I don't know, because I don't know any other shows. I mean, I don't watch a lot of comedy, I must say.
Oh.
But I don't know whether other shows that are written by a gang of people who, I mean, whose line is it anyway, perhaps, is people are making it up who are in it. But it doesn't have the rewrites or the, you know, we were writers and obsessive writers. There's hardly an ad lib in Monty Python.
So where would you distribute today, though? Because you can also think TikTok has a lot of comedy on it. Like, it's all distributed and fragmented. I mean, the Nudge Nudge guy would probably be a TikTok star, influencer, my guess. How do you cut through that noise now?
Well, I think the reason it became popular was because it was on PBS and it was on a Sunday night and everybody could get it. Nobody was counting the figures, but everybody could see it for about years after year after year.
That's where I watched it.
Yeah, and I think that was a remarkable, fortunate thing for us. And it spread it like a virus. You know? So I don't know anything about TikTok. I'm very ignorant. I live in my own little ivory tower. And I like writing and I like reading. I still like making people laugh.
Right. You'd be an influencer. You'd be an influencer, just so you know, on TikTok, probably.
I would be. If I knew what that meant, even.
Yes. Well, you know, you could do your characters over and over again.
Things. Is that what an influencer does?
Yes. But you could take any of your characters.
Thank you.
Mr. Idol, it's not too late. You could do makeup tutorials. You could do all kinds of things.
I've always dreamed of getting makeup tutorials.
So I'd love to move you to now today comedy and how you look at it. You say you don't look at it a lot. After you did British television, the BBC, you did work on sitcoms here in the United States. One was called Nearly Departed, where I remember it, where you played a ghost who was in a house. And then Suddenly Susan, which was with Brooke Shields. That wasn't a great experience for you, correct?
I mean, it should have been Suddenly Departed is actually what it was.
Yes.
It was only on for six. I did enjoy doing that a bit, but I'm not good at sitcom because it seems to be a hybrid form of comedy, pure comedy, which is what Python was. We could be anything, anywhere, just to make you laugh.
And
drama. You know, or maybe soap opera, but it's not my form. I think it's a kind of acting, and I'd rather do something sillier or moving along a bit. What I like to do is write a show and do it.
It's a very unforgiving format, the sitcom is, in a lot of ways.
Yes, but also it's often the same joke. You're repeating the same thing. Here's the same guy coming in the same, hello, darling, I'm back. You know, good. There's nothing new about it after a bit, I find. I mean, Brooke was wonderful, but I was only called in for 1 year, and I was supposed to be rude to her character all the time. That's why they employed me.
Right.
And then after the first week or so, they put it in front of one of those panels they convene and said, oh, people don't like it when you're rude to her.
Because she's Brooke Shields, yeah.
Well, that just destroyed the purpose of being there, you know? So they took it in another direction, and you're much more at the mercy of executives in that form. I mean, they came to us once on Nearly Departed and said, wear more green. And we said, what? And they said, wear more green. I said, why? We said, well, we've done some studies and people like people who wear more green.
Wow.
I know.
Oh.
And I think the thing about comedy is it's disastrous when you want to be liked.
Yeah.
I think there's a slight difference between American humor, American television and English television, that it, on the whole, English comedians don't want to be loved or don't put that up front. Whereas I think it's very important in American terms that they're somehow liked or lovable.
Right. Did they edit you a lot at Monty Python, and what did they edit out?
They edited us hardly at all until about, they hardly watched it actually, which was good, until about the third series, and they cut one or two things, but only small things by today's standards.
Such as?
They cut out a sketch, which was a wine tasting sketch, and the guy said, what do you think of this? And I said, well, it's a Burgundy, it's light, dry, it's from the north side of the hill, it's probably a Sauvignon. No, sir, it is Wee Wee.
Oh.
And then he gave me another thing. Ah, now this is very much a Sauvignon, proper grape. If you don't, no, sir, it is wee wee.
Okay, so no urine jokes.
It was completely a urine joke.
Yeah.
And I wrote it, I'm afraid to say. And John Cleese cut it. He went with the BBC, and I did a tour with him, and I made him do it every night with me, and it got huge laughs. So I got my own revenge.
Oh, that's good. Urine jokes are always good. How do you look at cancel culture today? Because now everybody is watched under great scrutiny. You didn't watch, for example, the Chappelle monologue, for example. Did you follow him?
No, I didn't, because my wife watches it and she says, oh, you should watch it because it's funny. He's funny, you know, and I said, oh, I will.
Well, what do you think of the comedians like Dave Chappelle, for example, is saying he's being subjected to censorship or that he can't say what he wants? He said it this week on SNL in his monologue.
Yeah, but where does he say it? On SNL?
That's right. Yeah, that's a fair price. Yeah.
You know, well, you're not being that much canceled, are you? If you were in your room complaining, I'd have a lot more sympathy.
Right, so that he doesn't pay the price. He just says he pays the price.
It worries me when I didn't like it when, you know, Bill Maher complains about the audience not laughing.
Mm-hmm.
They're telling you they don't find it funny.
Right.
You shouldn't moan about the audience. There's nothing wrong with the audience if they don't laugh at your jokes. There's something wrong with your joke. And so I'm not terribly sympathetic to that sort of attitude, to be honest.
That's well said. Yeah. Is there a comedian that you like? Do you think someone like Chappelle, who I think is brilliant many times, by the way? I just think he is obsessed with trans people in a really creepy way. Who do you think is doing a great job?
You mean my best friend, you know, was Robin Williams. You know, I haven't really recovered from that. I mean, you know, he was just so wonderful, and you had to know him an awfully long time before he stopped being funny.
Tell me about Robin Williams. What an incredible artist he was. Away from the more famous aspects of his life, if you watched him in stand-up, it was just brilliant.
I mean, I knew him very early on, and mm-hmm. he was still, I think I just met him just as, you know, he was doing that Mork and Mindy, and I took him to France, and he came mm-hmm. to stay, and we became very good friends. And then I'd follow him through San Francisco, and he'd go to all the clubs, now mm-hmm. endless clubs, and he was always brilliant. But then he would take medication and stop being funny.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, when he cleaned up, then he was always funny, but he was always mm-hmm. very sympathetic. He mm-hmm. had this great humanity to him, which was very kind and generous. And mm-hmm. I learned a lot from him how to treat people, public, when mm-hmm. you're with them. Because mm-hmm. I would be very rude and tell them to F off, you know. But
yeah.
he was always kindly to people, you know, and I learned a lot from that. And I, you know, I was devastated, obviously, like everybody else was. I mean, it was a shocking moment.
Support for this show comes from Virgin Atlantic. Travel can be stressful. I don't think that's a controversial take. Sure, we all love taking a vacation and that moment we finally get a chance to relax, but we're always so focused on the destination that the journey just feels like a means to an end. Well, what if it wasn't? What if the time you spent getting there was just as enjoyable as the vacation itself? That's what Virgin Atlantic believes. That's why they offer loads of special extra touches that make your trip one to remember for all the best reasons. Picture this, you made it to the airport, checked in your bags, and finally have a moment to settle in before takeoff. If you're flying upper class, you could be putting your feet up in a Virgin Atlantic clubhouse at London Heathrow with food made fresh to order and champagne delivered straight to your table with a tap of a QR code. I mean, it's rude not to, right? Once you're in the air, the experience continues with deliciously different dining, seriously comfy seats, and the best crew in the sky by miles. Check out virginatlantic.com for your next trip and see the world differently. Support for this show comes from Ramp. Are you overwhelmed with managing your business expenses, vendor payments, and accounting? Is your finance software just not cutting it? Or maybe you're just looking to cut all that wasteful spending. Ramp could be a total game changer for you and your business. Ramp is the corporate card and spend management software designed to help you save time and put money back in your pocket. Ramp gives finance teams unprecedented control and insight into company spending. With Ramp, you're able to issue cards to every employee with limits and restrictions and automate expense reporting so you can stop wasting time at the end of every month.
Plus Ramp is easy to use. You can get started, issue virtual and physical cards, and start making payments in less than 15 minutes, whether you have 5 employees or 5,000. Not only that, but Ramp can save you money. They estimated that businesses that use Ramp save an average of 5% the first year. And now you can get $250 when you join Ramp. Just go to ramp.com/Kara. 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 Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank. Members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
So Twitter, you're very active there. So is Elon Musk, the new lord, who is playing a peasant, who, the owner of it. I just am curious, why do you like Twitter? And have you had any changes since Elon took over from your perspective?
Well, I like Twitter because in the 90s, I started something when I came to America. I discovered how popular Monty Python was. In England, it was over and had been over 25 years. But in America, it was not only live, it was still on television and people loved it. So I started something and I noticed something about the early internet, which was that the two touch points of on the early internet were the Rolling Stones and Monty Python. There were the two references every nerds were referring to.
They love it. They do. Elon did too. He did the "to all complainers, please stop complaining. It will cost $8 was a Monty Python reference.
And spam was based on a Python sketch, you know. So, so I started a thing called Python Line and I would answer their questions. And I kind of enjoyed that interaction with people, you know, sometimes, you know. And so I, when Twitter came along, I kind of enjoyed that. And you find a small little community and providing you block a lot of people instantly.
Yeah, I do that a lot.
It was doable. And I, so I think it's important to remember that Elon is a Python fan. I mean, you know, I think, and also, you know, he's made brilliant cars. The Tesla is a brilliant thing. I think it was very generous to share all that technology with other car firms. The last thing American business should do, which has, because he wanted, you know, to make electric cars common, which is what he has succeeded in doing. And I think SpaceX is a jolly good thing too. I mean, you know, watching that rocket land on its backside was one of the most extraordinary moments of technology. I think that... you know, he and also he legendarily once shut down his Tesla factory while they were making Tesla 3 to play a Python sketch about Woody and Tinny because he wanted to get the correct sound of the car door slamming.
So, so you've been vocal about your feelings for him supporting the use of these, but you've also clapped back at him recently. What talk about that?
Yeah, well, I think he's been rather silly. I think he's been foolish and I think impulsive. And, you know, where's his support group? Who's helping him? Who's saying, don't say that? Or because I think once you get too big, it's like a rock star. I call it Louis the 14th. You know, nobody is telling you no. Nobody's saying, oh, that's a really bad idea. Why do that? You know, and I think that's the mistake. And I think one of my tweets recently was like, I said, it's like buying a petting zoo and charging the animals.
Yes, that is
for
correct.
The blue tick, you know. But he did say he stole the idea of charging it from the Monty Python's argument clinic.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, this is my first time.
I see. Do you want to have the full argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what would be the cost?
Well, yes, it's It's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only 8.
And I responded to that. Said I, you know, I said, well, you steal the idea from us, and you want to charge us to verify who we are.
Right, exactly. Right. You said, you said so many Elon trolls spouting garbage. It's going to be easy to leave. Ha ha. I'm going to read now. Ciao, Bella. But you love it too. I'm the same way. Let me just say. And by the way, what did you go read that was better than the drama at Twitter right now? I'm trying to think of what possibly could be as interesting.
I find it very uncomfortable now. I had a lot of people who were nice, and we were always, especially because my daughter's bipolar and very out with it, we were would encourage people who were depressed or sad. And you know, Monty Python has a very cheery uppy quality to it, which it attracts a lot of people who are depressed or sad or lonely. And it does a lot of good in that respect. Hank Azaria said he was filming a Holocaust movie, and he came to the conclusion that Monty Python was the opposite of the Holocaust.
Wow.
A very interesting quotation.
Oh, wow.
But was he cheered? You know, he had found reasons to be human again at the end of a day's filming.
Right.
You know, good things about humanity.
What's interesting is one of your fans, Elvis, sort of went downhill. Same reasons. Brilliant, but went downhill.
Elon is sort of doing the same. One of the more interesting things I thought you put about his free speech arguments, which aren't really, they're a little bit hypocritical in many cases. You've said that, quote, free speech for fascists is like putting diesel in a Tesla, which made me laugh really hard.
Well, you know, I grew up in that world. Don't forget, I'm a war baby.
Right, right, that's right.
And I was born in 1943, so it was very real to us, fascism and what can happen if you let one person take over a country. And so... You know, that still rings very strongly with me in my soul. And I think, you know, I don't know whether it's a kind of narcissism. I think it is buying that, and I think that to take it over and alienate both the people who are the audience and the people who bring them in by entertaining them or interacting with them is completely, utterly foolish.
I would agree with you, Mr. Idle.
Simple as that. Why wouldn't you just sit in your office and watch for a few months and see what, you know, I mean, but to come say, I'm going to change it all. I'm going to make this happen. Oh, no, I'm not. I'm going to do that. No, I won't do that. It's like, I don't think you just smoke joints and run a business. I think after the end of the day, it's very good for you when you've been making very good decisions. But during the day.
All right. Speaking of smoking joints, the British government. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to explain what's happening in the UK. You're very funny on Twitter about this. First, the Queen died this year, of course. And the joke, do you even know Britain had a queen? That's a Monty Python joke. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I don't. The reason I can't do that is because I've lived in California for 27 years.
And, so you're no longer British? You're not allowed to be British?
Well, I am British in passport, which now means I can't go anywhere on the continent for more than 90 days.
Right, okay.
That's one of the great advantages of Brexit, is they've stopped me going to my house in France. So I hate them intensely. I've always hated conservatives, I'm afraid to say. I'm very prejudiced against them. They're horrible people. And they've made a right mess of it. And they've gone back into austerity, which is the 12th time they've done it for the last 12 years, I think. So,
so not a fan of Rishi Sunak? Better than Truss, better than Lettucehead.
Well, I mean, when you say better than Truss, I have a friend called Jeffrey Archer who I had dinner with in London. Yeah. And he told me all the really good gossip. But the only trouble was I couldn't recognize any of the names. So I try not even to keep up too much with American politics because it was so depressing. And I have to escape to France to get away from the endless news cycle.
Do you pay attention to U.S. politics?
I stopped because I found myself completely addicted to it. And it's the same. It was always like always hope coming and then a bit of disappointment, the hope and the disappointment. And I thought, this is really anxiety making. And why people are so much depressed these days is I think there's just too much news. There isn't enough news for breaking news all day. It used to be half an hour on the BBC at 9 o'clock, you know. But now, and it's also then divided into partisan news and this news and fake news. And so I found that life was better without it. And if I go and live in a place, I like to be on the planet, on the edge of a planet, which gives you a much better grounding and a better grounding for your own inevitable demise. And so, you know, my wife was American, obviously. She follows it and she, you know, votes and, you know, agitates and does all that. And I don't. I'm afraid
is there anything funny in it? Do you find anything funny in it right now, or is it too soon?
I mean, yeah. I mean, from a bitter viewpoint, it's hilarious, you know, because you know, how would you possibly solve gun violence? Well, actually, very easily, but nobody will ever address it because there's no money in it. You can't get elected on it. You know, I mean, it's paradoxical and funny. But you know, you have to be kind of cynical, like I think I am slightly.
Much less than most people.
But I don't want to be, you know, when I had cancer, I suddenly thought to myself, you've got to stop being anti-people, some people, and pro-some people. So everybody gets cancer. And you can now, if you're going to appeal to people, you should appeal to people who've got the disease, not because they, you know, conform to whatever patterns of thought I believe in. And so I think I'm in a grace period of, you know, I'm in remission. So I have a grace period to to not
think
be
about
quite,
it.
Yeah, and not be quite so, you know, correct or, you know, not really correct. I mean, righteous.
Angry.
And I know
righteous.
What it is. I know what to say. Right. I know what to put you down.
So for people to know, the survival rate of pancreatic cancer is quite low and it's more deadly for men. Steve Jobs out of it. Tell us about, so how did it hit you, this diagnosis, and the recovery? The remission is quite remarkable for you.
I have a very good doctor, and that's the reason I'm alive today. He's my medical practitioner, practices preventative medicine. And so every year, he puts us in, we have blood tests, and you go through the old scan or two. And I was writing a thing called Death the Musical. some years ago.
Explain that.
Well,
explain Death the Musical.
Spamalot had been a big hit. And you think, well, what are we going to do now? And I tried to do The Life of Brian, and John Cleese said no, which was amazing to me. As a musical,
I think he's changed a lot too, John Cleese.
Anyway, he's old. He's 84. Okay. Oh, 80, right. 83 maybe. He's
very
83.
Angry 84, but go ahead.
I know, but that's sad, you know.
It is.
What have you learned? So I was trying to think, well, all the boomers are going to die. Death is a really fascinating subject. Why don't I try and write the Death the Musical? It's exactly the wrong title for a Broadway show.
Right.
Which, of course, it was because nobody wanted to buy it.
Right, but right. It hasn't been made. Let me just say the basic plot, this is from The Guardian, was simple. A man writing Death the Musical finds he is dying. Idol asked his doctor for advice. I said, what's the quickest way to get rid of a character? And he said, pancreatic cancer. This is the same doctor. Who end up diagnosing you.
Well, that's right. So that's what happened. I mean, I said, perfect. That's perfect. I thank you very much. And then 10 years later, we're actually doing a test. And I say, what's that? And he says, it's pancreatic cancer.
Oh, wow.
And I laughed because we'd written songs about this guy receiving the news. When he heard that he was dying, Freddie took it very well. Oh, shit, Jesus Christ, I'll fight you now. And things like that. So what could I do but laugh when it's now on?
Right.
You know,
so are you working on that music? You think it's going to get made?
No. you can't get investors for something as silly as that.
Why did you choose to share your story and what's the public reaction been?
Well, the public reaction was great. And I thought, it was after I did The Masked Singer and I knew they were going to ask me for due publicity because it was due.
You sang Love, Love Me Do, right? You sang a Beatles song.
I sang a Beatles song and I wrote to Paul to ask him because he owns that one. It isn't a Beatles song. So it's a PMC copyright. And he said, yes, you can do it, but just let me know when it airs so I can be sure to miss it. Because I played him in The Ruttles, you see.
Right, that's right, that's right. You did a great job, by the way. The upward-looking thing you do really well, that his eye thing that he
pushes
his eyes
that's
around.
What his wife loved. Linda just loved that. I think I nailed it.
So what's the reaction been?
The reaction was extraordinary. It was really great. I mean, first of all, the people I first talked to my doctor and my publicist, they both cried. And it's been very touching. And then when I came out on Twitter and I was inundated with people who had relatives or friends and who said, thank you. And I've had a lot of people just thank me. I was fortunate enough to be the survivor. And it's because I was diagnosed early. So I said, we must do a charity to encourage people to test early because now they're just getting breakthroughs and also as well as research. Mm-hmm. So I did Ally with Stand Up to Cancer and I started the Bright Side Fund. You know, it's probably one of the best things I've ever done.
Let me ask you a last question. It's a question I ask of Steve Jobs, who did die of pancreatic cancer. He was well for a while, then he got sick again. I think the last big interview of him and I was in this room and he looked very sick. He was obviously thin and very fragile, but one of the biggest life forces you ever saw, right up till the end. And I decided to ask this question. I'm going to ask it of you. And he gave an amazing answer, let me just say. So don't feel any pressure. What are you going to do with the rest of your life?
Well, I asked my doctor just recently because I was being tested every 6 months how long I had. And he said, cancer's gone. You've got maybe 10 years or more. And that was a shock to me. That's when I decided to raise money, help and encourage this cancer fund and to encourage people, because we're going to beat this thing. You know, I meet more and more survivors of this thing. And I think this is the part of humanity that I really love. We get better. We got people working away quietly, doing all this great work. And it mm-hmm. never hits the television. It's always about politics and shouting at each other. So I would say that humanity is an extraordinary species. We're an amazing Homo sapiens species, Homo sapiens mm-hmm. sapiens. And mm-hmm. our struggle is against the stupidity and folly. But also we are improving. We are capable of improving life mm-hmm. as we go. And life has improved.
Absolutely. Eric Idle, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. What a lovely interview.
Thanks, Cara. I enjoyed talking to you very much. It's on.
You know what they say, Cara?
What?
You're in or you're out.
Oh, my God. Don't do a pee joke. You just
wee wee.
Don't lose your day job as a producer, let's just say, to go into comedy.
Well, I'd anyway. Be great at it.
No. Mm-mm. No.
100 pee jokes.
100, no.
I see why you love Eric Idle.
Yeah, just a charmer. Just a lovely guy. Lovely guy. You know, you could turn bitter, and he hasn't. He's had such a great career. He's still very funny. He's delightful and pioneering. I don't know what else, you know. It's been a good run for him, and I'm glad that he's healthy.
I am, too.
Makes me happy.
I was surprised how little attention he pays to comedy currently.
Yeah, well.
He hadn't watched the Dave Chappelle monologue, despite his wife saying it was very funny.
I hope someday never to pay attention to journalism, and I'll be sitting in Hawaii, you know, with my coconuts.
Please. You're an addict, Cara.
No,
good
I'm
luck.
Not. No.
Good
I'm
luck.
Going to Hawaii. I'm getting a set of coconuts, and I'm going to run around the island going.
Okay. I'll believe it when I see it.
All right. We'll see. Anyway, what a great guy. What a great person to have on Thanksgiving. And I like a little hope. We're going for hopefulness this time.
Yeah, he was very hopeful. He was very hopeful. What did you take away from the conversation? What was the most salient thing for you?
I had forgotten how important Monty Python was to me as a young person when I was watching it in the 70s on PBS. It was great. What did you think?
I agree with you. I think his sense of life and his sense of joy throughout that interview was just fantastic. I also really appreciated him getting into the ins and outs of trying to make something. Like as a producer, I really appreciate that conversation of the friction between yourself and a network or yourself and, you know, that editorial tension and the kind of inane network notes that the wear more green.
You need to wear green, more green.
There's actually a great Twitter handle called @TV Network Notes. And these are all real notes, or they claim they're all real notes. Here's one from the History Network. All of these programs you've pitched us today are about the past. I'm really looking for something about the present.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus Louises. Yeah.
ABC, can we change the color of the girl's backpack?
I know, exactly.
What?
You and I, we've been on the receiving end of this.
Oh, you and I don't take notes.
We don't take notes.
Kara Swisher and Naima Raza don't take notes.
We get them given to us, but we ignore them completely.
We sometimes take each other's, but that's about it.
Not really.
Oh, come on, Kara. You had never done the Elon interview if I hadn't
that's
told
true. You. That's a fair point.
Speaking of notes, I'm getting a note from the producer saying we should get to the credits. So, Kara, you want to read us out?
Oh, my God. Yes. Today's show was produced by Naima Raza, Blake Nishik, Kristen Castro-Rossell, Rafaela Seward, and Claire Tai. Our engineers are Fernando Aruda and Rick Kwan, and our theme music is by Trackademics. If you're already following the show, you get a man following you with a pair of coconuts. If not, why don't you like coconuts? Go wherever you listen to podcasts, search for On with Kara Swisher, and hit follow. Thanks for listening to On with Kara Swisher from New York Magazine, the Vox Media Podcast Network, and us. We'll be back on Thursday with more.